From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack.
And this is one of our favorite annual traditions. We call it Rochester's Favorite Books 2019. That's the shorthand, but it's more than that, really. We ask prominent members of our community to come in and tell us about the book that stood out most to them in 2019. And that means for many of them, it was their favorite book of the year. For others, it was the book that was the most profound.
We've enjoyed putting the show together every year since 2014. This year, our guests have chosen a wide range of books to make you think, laugh, and cry. It's a chance to build a little reading list for 2020. So, are you ready? Let's get started.
Rochester's Favorite Books 2019 as we head for 2020. And our colleague here at WXXI, Jeff Spivak, is here. You read books, do you?
I do, and there's very few pictures in them.
Well, we as a society read fewer and fewer books, but I am not surprised that you are a bookworm. What did you choose for your favorite book or most memorable read?
It's been a battle for just trying to figure this out. I was thinking about George Saunders' Lincoln and the Bardo, but I don't think I can properly explain that book because it is just so out there.
It is pretty strange.
Yeah, I love it. I know there's something really good going on here. I just don't have my hand on it.
That's a guy, actually, I thought about interviewing, but I'd have to read the book about six times before I can really figure it out.
Yeah, he's a very nice fellow, and he would explain it to you and not make you feel like you were being dumb. He's just, there's just a lot going on in that book, and once you figure out that just about every character in that book is dead, then, except for Lincoln at that time, then it starts to fall into place. And I was thinking about Ron Chernow's Grant, which is, by the time I finish reading it, I think it's going to be one of my favorite books ever. It's amazing, but I'm only halfway through, so that doesn't—
How many pages? About 1,000?
It's close to 1,000 pages, and I'm not even through the Civil War yet.
Okay.
And we still have to get through the incredible graft of his administration, the corruption, which really is unmatched in history until very recently.
I don't know what you could possibly be referring to, but why don't you tell us about the book you did choose?
Walter Isaacson's Benjamin Franklin.
Oh.
I read that this spring. It's amazing because I think we all know Benjamin Franklin. And pretty much what you know is true, but the way Isaacson puts it together, and he makes it feel so real. And I walked away from this book. I walked away from it thinking, this guy is one of the most amazing Americans ever. We all take for granted the stuff he did. But at one point, when he did his, everybody knows about the electrical flying the kite.
Which was a true story, huh?
It's true, absolutely true. He also used electricity to fry turkeys. So he knew how to, you know, try all kinds of different doors and with electricity. But he's flying a kite. And at that time, that made him the most famous person in the world. Just that flying a kite in a thunderstorm thing. And he's just an amazing guy because here he is moving in the corridors of power in Philadelphia. And they one of his contemporaries described him as looking like a big farmer. This guy had no pretension about him. He was, you know, he was very good at promoting things he was doing, but what he was promoting was amazing. He was an amazing writer, and that's one thing that really attracts me to him. He really understood how to use words, and he knew how to take something, like say he was nearsighted and farsighted. So he decided, well, if I take my glasses I wear for reading and I take my glasses I need for farsighted things and put them together, I have bifocals. So he invented that. Everything was very pragmatic that came out of him. And he was such an amazing guy, too, because he could change his mind about things. And so many times people don't do that. Ben Franklin did own several slaves. And he came to realize that, no, this is wrong. And his slaves, he basically let his slaves just walk away. But he was able to understand that even while some of his more lauded contemporaries like Thomas Jefferson continued to own people, Franklin was smart enough to say, no, I'm going to change my mind on this. This is wrong. So this guy would come up with ideas like that because he realized that, or he said that, your opinions are probably not really your own. Your opinions come from the times and who you were around, and you just kind of like collate all these things. So he was able to like see that as the tide was turning against something like owning another human being.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that he could adapt to that. And to me, that people want to call him a genius, and I just don't know if he was a genius, but he was a genius in understanding how to be flexible and promote himself a little bit. The idea of Franklin being a ladies' man was maybe a little bit of him building up his own reputation. But
mythology.
Yeah, a little self-mythologizing, but harmless stuff. But, you know, a guy like him who would, like, lie in his bed naked in the morning with the windows open because it was an air bath. It was his experiencing the environment around him. Now, I don't want my neighbors to be doing this, you know, but just very a complex man, yet, as we say, kind of the salt of the earth, and really not afraid to confront the great minds like Jefferson. I don't know how many people are aware of what Franklin's contributions were to the Declaration of Independence, but Jefferson, and I have it right here in front of me, when he wrote, "We hold these truths to be sacred and undeniable," Franklin sensed, well, there's a little bit of a religious thing that I don't think I want in there. He changed that to, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." That was Franklin's hand on that, yeah. So we don't even know, you know, we attribute the Declaration of Independence in large part to Jefferson and the people who influenced Jefferson. But Franklin, you know, that's the big phrase, and Franklin nailed it down for him.
Jeff Spivak, your choice was Walter Isaacson's
Ben Franklin.
Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
Our next guest is Crystal Ellis, Director of Communications for the Ronald McDonald House, an influencer and a culture shifter. Welcome to you, Crystal. So nice to have you back in the studio.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here again.
I love it. When I reached out to you to ask you which book you were thinking of, you sent that right away.
Yeah.
You have this dog-eared copy sitting on the table here in the studio. This book looks like it's been through a journey. Tell us the title and the author.
So the title of this book is The Power of One Thing, How to Intentionally Change Your Life. And the author is Dr. Randy Carlson.
Tell us a little bit about why you chose this book.
Oh, my gosh. So I'll tell you a quick backstory. I was volunteering at some place, and I saw it was like a place to get books or something. So I picked it up. It's like, oh, I would like to read that really quickly. Picked it up. And 4 years later, this year, I finally read it. And I'm always attracted to things or literature that changes your life or it's motivational. So that's what attracted me to it. And can I tell you, it is a blow your mind book if you are trying to figure out what your purpose is, but not necessarily only that, but how to get there, because life can be overwhelming.
So I'm glad you said that, because I was talking to a friend recently about books of this nature, whether they're self-help books or motivational books. And we were saying, you know, a lot of what they write is platitude-based. And how do you actually apply it? What's tangible? What's an action item? And it sounds like this book takes care of that issue. So what for you was the action item or the tangibility?
What is great about this book is I've noticed with other self-help books is they give you a million things to do all at once. And you're like, okay, after you've read the book and highlighted it all, you give up because it's like, who's going to go back and remember that? So the summary of this book is The Power of One Thing, which means, for example, if you are wanting to create a business or fix something that's happening emotionally in your life that's taxing, it says, wake up every morning, and think about your day. We have the tendency to just go, go, go. We look at our calendar and we go to the meeting, but we don't actually cast a vision for our day. And what the book tells you to do is be mindful of your time and focus on one thing at a time so that you could get closer to your goal. And I mean, honestly, we're all walking around life and we, no matter where we are, we ask that question, what are we here to do? And we become so paralyzed with fear that we don't do anything at all. And we're looking for everyone to help us. We're looking for someone to give us a handout, not knowing that the power that we need to get to the next level is living right on the inside of us. But it's just for us to say, what am I going to do today to push me towards my purpose? And that's how that book, this book, The Power of One Thing, gets you to start to think about being intentional about everything.
Being mindful.
Yeah.
So when you woke up this morning, every day, do you wake up and do you choose one thing for your day?
Or oh
how do you
gosh,
identify?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Tell me about today then.
All right. So today I got up and I was like, okay, what am I going to do today? And I prepared myself from yesterday for today because I'm in love with the city of Rochester and I don't take moments like these lightly. And I got up today, and the first thing I did is I put on some motivational YouTube videos. I always start my morning that way. I get up, no distractions before I eat, before I answer a phone call, check email. I always put on something motivational to clear my mind. And then I said, all right, when I get here, what I want to do is send a message to the city of Rochester is that there is hope, that despite of what's happening on the news that we see every day, you see all the bad news, but the city of Rochester is a glorious city. Beautiful things come out of this city, and it's not because it's just where all the cool people are. It's because each and every individual comes together to make this beautiful thing. So if you're sitting in a library by yourself, if you're sitting in Department of Social Services, because sometimes we don't mention those folks, even if you're sitting in the boardroom, you are called to do something great. So when I got up this morning, I wanted to send that message. If I do anything else for the rest of the day, if I do nothing else for the rest of the day, that is when I want to tell the city of Rochester, we are great and we need every single person to know that about themselves. Just start the one thing.
I feel like you, whenever I see you, you're so full of life, so full of energy, so happy. You've overcome a lot in your life.
Yeah.
And I love your spirit. And this might seem like a strange question, but do you feel like you were this inspired and motivated before experiencing those obstacles that you had? And if you want to share with our listeners who may not be familiar with your story, some of the things that you've overcome.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if you're the person now because of that, or if you've always been this person who's been so full of joy.
Gosh, that's a really good question. Trust me, I'm transparent. So you could ask me absolutely anything and everything. So City Rochester and beyond, here we go. was I always this person? At a very young age, I've always been aware and has had this wild intuition about things and people. But I kind of, like we all do, we have those years where we're like wishy-washy, like, all right, we're just kind of like living. And then after moving here to the city of Rochester, because I'm from Florida, the light bulb turned on for me because I was heading in the direction that wasn't good for me and the people around me. So I wisened up, and after being, I guess, hit in the face with the threat of death because of the cancer diagnosis, I knew that I had to start living life with direction, but on my own terms, and I have to change the world around me with this story. So, yeah, it kind of hit in 2008 was the year. I could actually pin it. 2008 was the year. But I've always been happy. Always been happy, because what's the point of having something steal your joy? And then that thing or those people are going to go on and live their life, not even thinking about what they stole from you, the time they took from you, how they damaged you or whatever it was. And then you're sitting there in pain, in sadness, anxiety. I'm not going to let someone live rent free in my heart and in my mind. Absolutely not. So I've always been this way.
Wow. You are awesome.
Thanks.
So I guess the message for our listeners, if you're not born like Crystal Ellis, read The Power of One Thing. Repeat the author for us one more time, Crystal.
The Power of One Thing, How to Intentionally Change Your Life by Dr. Randy Carlson. Go grab a copy.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year.
Oh, Happy New Year to you.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2019, and our next guest is a professor of history at the University of Rochester. It's Pablo Miguel Sierra Silva, who first joined us back in 2014 when it was World Cup time, and I keep asking you to come back because I wish I had you in class. I never took a class with you, so that's why we invite you in. Nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
Well, so you had a busy year because we're going to talk about the book you chose, but you just published a book, a long, long labor of scholarship. Tell us briefly about the book, because we'll talk about it on the show in 2020, but tell us a little bit about the book.
Sure, absolutely. Urban Slavery in Colonial Mexico is the first long-durée approach to the history of enslaved people in the city of Puebla, which is my hometown in Mexico. And that took about 13 years to complete. So it's a study of people, spaces, their families, and how we have to rethink the Latin American city based on experiences of slavery.
Identity part of it too, right?
A huge part of it. And the denial of identity is pretty important to that narrative too.
All right, we'll pause that conversation there and come back to talk about Pablo's book soon. But the book that you chose that stood out to you in 2019, what was it?
Sure. So this is The Book of Chameleons by José Eduardo Agualusa. Agualusa is an Angolan author and one of the most celebrated writers of the Portuguese-speaking world. And I came to this book because a professor of Brazilian history visited campus last year. And he said, you know, if you're into novellas, if you're into the short story genre, this is for you. And he was absolutely right.
Okay. Why? What stood out about
it? It's a story about perspectives and about a man who sells the past to people. He creates identities for folks who are looking for new starts or perhaps are trying to escape old habits, as it were. But the real kicker here is that the protagonist, the narrator, is a gecko. Is a gecko who lives on a wall and has a really interesting relationship with a man who fabricates these pasts. So it's an exercise into how we remember, how we choose to forget, and how our non-human counterparts maybe remember us and how maybe they perceive us.
Oh, interesting.
And all the strange things we do.
Yeah. What are the types of situations in which people need to reinvent their own identities?
Ooh, so many different kinds. A difficult political season, an unfortunate experience as a child, as a teenager in high school, a lost opportunity in college, a bad dinner date. There's so many things that go wrong with our lives, and we're always trying to find ways to reconstitute ourselves. It's just that it's not often the case that we have a gecko filter that for us.
That's interesting. And it's a theme that has been explored in certain artistic venues in recent decades, this idea of one of the ideas is, could we erase our own memory? Should we, if we could? Another is, do we want to create a new identity? Is the creation of identity in the Book of Chameleons complete with erasure of memory or not?
Well, I think it's layered into it. What this particular book addresses is the creation of documents that enable us to fabricate new identities. And that takes us back to that fake driver's license that many of us had.
Excuse me?
Many of us, not all of us. And then
don't say us.
The more complicated forms of identity, the birth certificates, a fake journal, a painting that portrays a family that's not our own, but could be. Those kind of documents that we can all assemble to create these narratives about ourselves, or perhaps about who we would want to be if we had another shot.
All right. And once again, the name of the book and the author?
It's The Book of Chameleons by José Eduardo Agualusa.
And I will say this. I bet you your wife's Portuguese is better than yours.
It's much better.
We're gonna talk to Molly in 2020. We'll put her on the list. Pablo and Molly are this dynamic duo, professors, authors, scholars, and Pablo Miguel Sierra Silva, an author in his own right. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you in 2020.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest is Reverend Dr. Stephen Cady, the senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Dr. Cady, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I cannot wait to hear what your favorite book is. I'm sure you read a lot throughout the year.
I read quite a bit throughout the year. And the strange thing is choosing this book is a little different. I don't normally read novels, but this was one that I found when I received the call or the email about if I had a favorite book. I had just finished it, and I thought, I think I'm going to choose this one because I really enjoyed it. So the book that I chose is called Marley by John Clinch. It's a new book that came out in October, and it tells the story of Jacob Marley behind A Christmas Carol, so Ebenezer Scrooge's partner.
So tell us a little bit about the plot. Obviously, it's a novel. And
sure,
it's
a novel.
What made you choose it, actually? I should ask you that first.
Why did I choose it?
Yeah. What drew your attention?
So, I do kind of like stories that give you a little, that take a familiar story and give you a little background on it. And sometimes that can be done really poorly, and they try and write in the same voice. John Clinch doesn't attempt to write in the same voice as Charles Dickens, and I'm not sure that he could. It takes a familiar story and tells the background to it and gives you a little insight into a life that I think a lot of us have kind of this whitewashed version of what Ebenezer Scrooge was. I mean, we've seen The Christmas Carol so many times and musical versions and all of these other things and the old Disney versions. But the truth is the story is really disturbing when you think about what greed does to a person and what loneliness does to a person. So I think Jacob, the story, the way that they take it is, way that John Clinch takes the story of Marley, he imagines what business Jacob Marley and Ebenezer Scrooge were actually in, and he chooses the slave trade. And basically the story tells how they made their money and what sort of unrepentant capitalism can do to people. And It's really fascinating. And in a moment where we are kind of looking around the world and saying, how can someone who spends their life in unrepentant greed, in serial adultery, in compulsive deceit, still find their way ahead? This offers a little character study in a very different culture at a very different time, but enough similarities that you say, oh, I see. And it can warn you about how to maybe not allow the same thing to happen to us.
We talk a lot on the show about how people form certain beliefs or how their own life experiences have led them to do certain things or believe certain things. And I'm not condoning any choices that this character has made in the book. But did you learn anything? Of course, it's a novel, it's fiction. Did you learn anything about his character that made you think, oh, this is probably why you ended up the person that you became?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, if I'm, you know, I'm coming from a perspective of faith, obviously. So I often think about what are the gifts that we've been given and what are the choices that we make in terms of how to use them. And here's a story about a man who is clearly brilliant and is able to make sense of the world in unique ways and chooses to use it poorly, to manipulate people and to take advantage of people and to really only care about his own well-being. And it has a detrimental effect on those around them. I mean, that I don't want to give away too much of the book, but one of the most fascinating pieces of the book is you have these episodes. If you've read the original A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, you have these moments when, you know, he's visited by the ghosts of Christmas past, where he goes back and you kind of see these points at which he could have gone in various directions, and you see a different kind of Ebenezer who, fortunately, that's a redemptive story. In the end, you see some of it come back, so there's hope in that. But in the story of Marley, you see kind of how he went down the path where we find him at the beginning of A Christmas Carol. I mean, the Christmas Carol starts with, you know, Marley was dead to begin with. And so this is a story where it kind of gives you the background about how that came to be and the life that he spent. And basically it has them as childhood friends, or as friends that meet away at this boarding school, and where they go, how their paths connect and diverge in various ways, and how Ebenezer Scrooge goes down the path to become the person that we know him to be at the beginning of A Christmas Carol.
With all the reading that you do every year, I'm sure a lot of what you read either becomes part of what you talk about in church or informs some kind of lecture, homily, whatever it is that you give. Is there something from this book that you think you'd bring into Asbury?
You know, one of the things that is a good reminder of what this, you know, so often we think the slave trade is so far removed now, right? Here we are 150 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. And, you know, one of the other books that I reread this year was called The Half Has Never Been Told. It's by Edward Baptist. And I was reading it in anticipation of a speech that I gave on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the citywide celebration. And one of the things that it does is trace the connection of American culture and the rise of capitalism, in fact, the viability of American culture to the slave trade, and to say it's easy to sit in the North and to look down our noses at the slavers in the South. But the truth is, almost all of the wealth that was developed in the United States and the viability of the United States was built on torture. And this book sort of reminds me of that. There's a statistic in the other book that I was mentioning, which is The Half Has Never Been Told, that, you know, in 1800, in 1801, the average slave could pick around, I think it was something like 34 pounds, no, it was 28 pounds of cotton in a day, which is a lot of cotton, 28 pounds in a day. 50 years later, in 1851, the average slave could pick 134 pounds of cotton. During that time, those 50 years, there was no industrial invention that would have lent itself to that. It was simply torture. And I think we need to remember that if we forced a whole group of human beings for our own wealth, our own greed, to live as if they were not human beings. We turned them into human chattel. And the story of Marley goes back and imagines the greed that the people who prospered as a result. And I think it's worth remembering over and over again, but certainly that will come out in sermons and in other places.
Thank you so much for coming in. Repeat the title and the author for us, just in case.
The book is Marley by John Clinch.
Dr. Katie, thank you so much. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Let's take our only break of the hour, and we're back with more of Rochester's Favorite Books 2019 in a moment. It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2019, one of our favorite annual traditions. And we don't always invite the same people year after year, so this next guest doesn't even know how privileged he is to be invited back again. Adam Frank is an astrophysicist and the author of a book in his own right called The Light of the Stars, among other books, by the way. But the most recent book really sort of making us understand how climate change makes us kin to all the technological civilizations across the universe. Small topic. That's probably what you figured you'd be doing in third grade when you're thinking about it, right?
Yes, absolutely. Exactly. I was already writing it then, by the way.
Yeah, it's been a long one in the making. But by the way, I do want to kind of go back a little and think about the first time we ever did Rochester's Favorite Books, like 5 years ago. You, I don't remember the book. I don't know if it was a Three-Body Problem series or something like that, but you made the remark that how amazing it is that we can walk outside and breathe under the sky and not die.
That was The Expanse. That was one of the Expanse books, because that was a character talking
no way
about that, about how amazing it is to live in a in a place, you know, because and Mars or everywhere else in the solar system, everybody's living under domes. And on Earth, you can just walk out and be under a sky
and breathe
And that was so amazing for the people who'd grown up on these other parts of the solar system.
So that was The Expanse in a past life book project. This year, the standout book from 2019. Tell me about it. What is it?
It's not science fiction and it's not climate. It's actually history. And it's called The Crowded Hour, Theodore Roosevelt, The Rough Riders, and The Dawn of the American Century by Clay Risen.
How'd you get turned on to it?
Clay Risen is an editor at the New York Times op-ed. And actually, I've worked with him a few times on, you know, the times I've done with stuff for the New York Times. And I love Teddy Roosevelt. So, you know, I was talking to him one time and he was telling me about his new book. And when it came out, I was just like, oh, this is a really interesting subject to me because, you know, Teddy Roosevelt is my favorite president. And I think he's archetypal in many ways. There's also problematic in some sense, some of the things that Teddy did.
We're all problematic.
Exactly.
And I don't mean to be glib about that.
No, I understand. But, and that's what makes him interesting, though.
And it doesn't wave it away, but it is interesting. Okay.
Right.
Go ahead.
And it's also a particular moment in American history that I was really interested in, which is this turn from, you know, it's after the Civil War. America is trying to heal after the Civil War. And, of course, what Teddy Roosevelt was all about American empire. He wanted America to be a player on the world stage. And so, you know, the Rough Riders, I didn't know much about it. I just know the usual story about the storming of San Juan Hill. I just wanted to learn more about it. And it ended up being just one of those history books where the history really comes alive. It's not just the history and you're learning things. And it's great. I learned amazing things about America and race and about America and empire. But it was just a great war story, too, of like, you know, the actual campaign to take Cuba.
So great history, great scholarship, but is it instructive for the modern day?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, because, you know, there were a number of different things that were interesting. Of course, there's this moment when America is deciding that it's going to play a role on the world stage, where beforehand America was like, no, you know, we don't get involved in foreign entanglements. But the other thing that was really interesting was race, the role of race in this story. Because one of the things, you know, that I didn't clearly understand was at this moment, so this is, late 19th century, 1893, 1894, it's that whole period, the last decade, America was trying to heal from the Civil War. And the campaign against Cuba, to go to war with Cuba, was seen as being bringing the South and the North back together. But unfortunately, as is so much with the history of race in America, it was done at the expense of African Americans. The way in which African Americans who played a role in this campaign, there were African American soldiers, there were African American cowboys who, because, you know, part of the people who were drawn into the Rough Riders and the army were there were still a lot of cowboys around. And of course, there was quite a few black cowboys. Their role, they were brave fighters in this campaign. And, you know, their role got so erased. And in general, just seeing this discussion of how, in order to bring the North and the South together, you know, the government or whatever, you know, the powers that be had to ignore what had happened and was happening to African Americans in the South, the loss of their voter rights, the just general oppression that they were facing. And so in order to heal North and South, you know, the powers that be had to sort of ignore the continuing oppression of African Americans in the South.
A lot of concern about white healing.
Yeah, right. Exactly. That's exactly what it was. They wanted to bring the country together, but as had happened so many times, it was at the expense of African Americans.
Yeah. Now, Teddy Roosevelt, I would love to see him in me, but he would probably be find it embarrassing that I've got a problem with spiders, considering the man traveled. He was literally an explorer.
He was.
Charting out new territory. He loved to be on the road. He did a lot of that post-presidency. You see any Teddy Roosevelt in Adam Frank?
Well, here's the thing about Teddy Roosevelt is that, like, you know, so I'm an American guy, and there's a lot I'm proud of in being an American guy. And if you're an American guy, Teddy Roosevelt is your figure. Right. Because he was an explorer. He was a great reformer. You know, he had great compassion for people less fortunate than he, and he fought for them. But he was also, like there's this great line from the book that I like when he first met Leonard Wood, who was going to be the leader of the Rough Riders. And they just loved each other because they were both, you know, kind of the same kind of guy. And there's this great quote. After they met, they hiked in Rock Creek Park. They kicked footballs. They got in the boxing ring and punched each other in the face. I'm like, oh yeah, that's what American guyhood is all about.
Well, I think of my best friend, I think. Yeah, that's what we're going
to
do.
So, you know, I mean, like so much about American guyhood, there's lots to be, you know, proud of our tradition. And there's also, you know, problematic things in our tradition. And Roosevelt embodies, you know, both sides of that. But particularly for me, what I love about Teddy Roosevelt is the conservation. You know, he was instrumental in the founding of the parks, of the great American parks. And, you know, I'm a big backpacker. I love being in the backcountry, and that, you know, I've always looked to him. And there's a bunch of people during that era, but you know, Teddy Roosevelt in particular, being that he was the president of the United States, having that feel for, you know, he loved the backcountry wherever it was.
All right. Once again, the name of the book and the author.
The name of the book and the author is The Crowded Hour: Theodore Roosevelt, the Rough Riders, and the Dawn of the American Century by Clay Risen.
Thanks for coming in. Happy New Year. We'll talk to you in 2020.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Our next guest, as we talk about Rochester and Western New York's favorite books of 2019, is Allie O'Malley, the CEO of Resolve of Greater Rochester. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So nice to see you.
It's nice to be here.
Tell me what your book is that you've chosen.
So the book that I chose this year is called Work is Love Made Visible. And I went looking for a book as I was thinking about what I want to do career-wise and where I kind of was on my leadership path. And what compelled me to pick up this book was the conversation throughout it, which is about how do you find your purpose in your work.
The work that you do every day is very demanding, very emotionally demanding. And I know that you're someone who does love their job because you bring such passion to what you do. Is that what this book is about, or is it more about finding where your passion is?
Well, this book is a series of essays that has a variety of different leaders across multiple segments. Of course, I work in the nonprofit segment, which is always hard work. I don't know anybody who chooses to do this work that isn't really compelled by it. So in many ways, I found my purpose when I chose this line of work. But how do you then bring that into your style of leadership? And so it was really interesting to read all these essays that all started from the same question from Peter Drucker, that was, what do you see when you look out the window that's not yet visible to others? And then how do you approach your work from that vantage point?
So if I were to ask you that question, what would your answer be after reading this book?
Well, for me, what's always been out that window that other people don't see is that I believe we can bring an end to domestic violence. And how do I, as a leader, rally people around that idea instead of accepting that all we're ever going to do is respond to it?
Do you feel that any of the essays in the book spoke to you specifically? Was there one that really stood out?
There was, and I marked it, so I had a feeling you were going to ask me. This particular was called The Work of New World Leaders, and the person who wrote it was a woman named Stephanie Pace Marshall. And she talks about how does your leadership narrative show up? And so I really liked some of the questions, particularly at the end of the chapter where she talked about, you know, when we lead, we cannot create what we have not yet become, and that leadership is first an inside job. And there's no space between what we say, what we do, and why. So I thought that that was really powerful. And the other notion within an organization is that culture eats strategy for breakfast, and leaders create culture. And I really
love that.
That's actually a quote from Peter Drucker, but she references it in this particular essay.
So you are the leader of Resolve, and you're the CEO. So you're obviously, you know, in a very high position. But I think what we can also talk about is everyone can be a leader in their own right, whatever position they have at a job. You know, you don't have to be at the top of the hierarchy. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice would you give to someone who is looking to maybe change or build on their leadership style, who isn't in some kind of managerial role, but really wants to be more of an outward leader?
You know, I think that that's a great point. And I think it's so important. And it's one of the points they make in the book. But the idea that we are all leaders, we're all leaders in our own lives. And so how do you show up as a leader, no matter what role you're in an organization, whether you're volunteering or you're a staff or faculty member, you get to choose who you want to be and how you want to live your life. And that's one of the reasons I really like this book, because it talks about all levels of leadership, and that in the new world order, if you will, everybody's a leader, and leader is no longer hierarchical. It's very circular. And so we need leaders to show up at all levels of an organization and be willing to be strong and press forward.
Is there someone that you consider a role model when it comes to leadership? I know there are examples in the book that maybe you identified with, but just in your own personal career journey, is there one person that stands out to you as someone that you aspired to be like?
Well, I don't know that I aspire to be like her, but she inspires me in Mother Teresa.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you're doing work serving vulnerable people, hers were certainly the most vulnerable. But you have to embody that spirit and that desire and that intention to do good work on behalf of other living beings.
Repeat the title and the author of the book for our listeners.
The title is Work is Love Made Visible, and it's by Frances Hesselbein.
Thank you so much. Ali O'Malley, nice to see you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
It's Rochester's Favorite Books 2019, and our next guest is Sherry Halliday Kwan, who is the lead minister at the First Unitarian Church of Rochester. How long have you been in Rochester now? What's it been?
4 months.
4 months.
We're getting there.
We've dragged you in here like four times. So you're like a once-a-month guest. I'm sorry about that.
It's an acceptable rate.
Yeah, it's an acceptable rate. And so it's been a busy, busy year, a move, settling into a new community, a leadership position. And I thought, boy, I'm very curious to know what you're squeezing time in to read. What is your choice for 2019?
Well, fortunately, there were lots of months in 2019 before I moved to Rochester. Yes. So I did have a little bit of time to read. And the favorite for me this year was The Leavers by Lisa Coe. It came out a couple of years ago, and I just got around to reading it, even though it was on my book list or on my nightstand, I should say, for 2 years since it came out. It's the leavers as in people who leave.
Okay. Tell us more.
Great. So it takes place largely in the Northeast, in New York and Connecticut, and it's about a Chinese immigrant family. That's all I knew about it before I picked it up, that it was a novel about a Chinese immigrant family that took place in New York City, which is where I was about to leave. And so I thought, great, now's the time to read it. And it follows this child named Deming, who immigrates with his mother, and they're separated, and he's adopted by a white family. And it's a fictional novel, but it traces the ways family separation has worked in this country for a long time now. And so it takes up some really, really big themes, but through a personal story.
Do you find yourself gravitating more to fiction or nonfiction?
In the work that I do, I get to hear a lot of stories, and I also grapple with big community issues. So I read a lot of nonfiction for my work, for preaching research, but when it's something that I want to read just for me, I read fiction.
This one, well, obviously, it grabbed you and kept you, but are there any times where you're reading and you think, you know what, I'm 40 pages in, I'm 60 pages, I can't do this, it's not working for me?
Yeah, I used to be one of those people who would really trudge through.
Yeah.
And these days I realize I'm fairly young, but we never know how much time we have. So yeah. I'm going to set it down and pick something new. There are too many books to read bad books.
What do you think people will get out of The Leavers?
Well, I think it's a gripping story. So if that's all you get, that's a good use of your time. But I also think it's a really compelling look into our immigration system that gives context. That's something that I didn't know about. My guess is for lots of listeners and readers, that'll be true too.
So a lot of debate in the fiction world in particular, young adult, but also all genres of fiction regarding the experience of the author and how sort of far afield the author can go if they haven't had that experience or don't come from certain representative backgrounds. How do you feel about that debate?
Yeah, well, I think it can't be answered simply, right? So I'm not willing to, and I'm fundamentally uninterested in giving one general rule that can be applied across all authors and all works. I think it is important to write from and to live fully from your own experience. But I do think that art allows us to expand those horizons and take on possibilities. So Lisa Coe is a Chinese American author, but she's writing from an experience that is different than her own. All fiction writers are doing that to some extent. But how are you in relationship with that community? What sort of accountability do you see yourself in to that community? That feels important to me.
Yeah, and so I actually really appreciate your answer here. The idea that we can't boil things down to one simple rule. And I think whether it is the brevity of social media or the media in general, as if it could be a monolith, but to sort of generally speaking, I do think that we sort of bifurcate everything. It's like, well, there's, you know, everyone's too sensitive versus, you know, everyone, you know, is wrong. I mean, it just, I think it is a good wise rule as we go into 2020 to allow for nuance and to allow for moments where we discuss things and say that some might be a misstep and in some cases we might be overanalyzing. I don't think there is one single rule. And I guess I want to say I appreciate that.
Thank you. I'm trying to live that way as best as I can.
Are we getting better at allowing for nuance or worse?
Ooh, in public discourse, we're probably getting worse. But, you know, as much as we think things are bad now, if you go and look at especially print media from 50 years ago or 100 years ago, things were pretty bad then, too, in terms of how people talked at and about each other. So I'd like to say we're getting better. I am, again, I'm working at it every day, not just personally, but that's why we come to church. So,
well, the lead minister for the First Unitarian Church of Rochester has given us a lot of your time. Happy New Year, and we hope to have many meaningful conversations in 2020.
Happy New Year to you.
And by the way, the book is The Levers by Lisa Coe.
Our next guest is Samiha Islam. She's a senior at Brighton High School. Welcome back to the station. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too.
Tell me about your book that you chose, the best book that you read in 2019.
So my favorite book from this year has to be The Traitor Prince by C.J. Redwine. So it's about a boy named Prince Javan, and he is this really academically studious, really ambitious heir to the throne of his kingdom. But he's been away at boarding school for like a long time, and he's very ready to take over the throne. And on his way back to his hometown from the school, his carriage actually gets ambushed, and an imposter comes and makes a big switcheroo with him. And he ends up being stranded in a city while somebody else returns and takes his place. And as he tries to like get his name cleared and tries to get back to the throne that he deserves, he ends up getting thrown into prison. And he meets a girl named Sajda, who is she has a lot of secrets. She's very mysterious. And they work together to try and get him out. And along the way, he learns a lot about sacrifice and duty. And it's a really good book.
Where did you come across it? Do you read a lot?
I tried to read a lot this summer. So in like the Brighton Library, I go there. I tried to go once a week.
So when you think about your preferences when it comes to reading, do you gravitate toward fiction, nonfiction? This sounds like a novel. Is that generally what you go toward?
I'm a big fan of like fantasy, otherworldly kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite book of all time? I know we're going past 2019. Ooh. Just to talk about, big question, I know, but if you had to choose one book.
Of all time, can I pick a series?
Absolutely.
Firewalker by Josephine Angelini. It's like a trilogy. That series is amazing. So that one is about a girl whose name I can't remember now that I'm trying to think about it. And she basically has like a lot of allergies. She doesn't really fit in like her high school and her world, and she's struggling a lot and she's always very sick. And then one day she wakes up and she lives in Salem, Massachusetts, but then she wakes up in this alternate dimension of Salem, Massachusetts, where it's like the Salem witch trials, except that the witches didn't get executed. They took over and they became like the queens of the world. And so she's this witch with like these magical powers, and she meets all of these people who are supposed to look up to her, but she actually has a doppelganger in that world who's like an evil version of her. So she has to try to use the powers that she never knew she had to overthrow the evil version of her.
It sounds like mistaken identities and doppelgangers are kind of a theme with you in books.
Oh my gosh, it looks like it.
When you think about the reading list that you have at school, do you appreciate what you're reading in school? Do you like the reading list? You have been on the show before talking about a lot of different things, inclusion included. Do you think that the reading lists at your school are
meeting your expectations?
I personally don't like to read classical books like Shakespeare, John Milton, all that stuff. It's not really my favorite. I do see the value in it, but I think, especially in English classrooms, it's important to talk about uncomfortable topics, not just, you know, looking at the same stories from like one white man's perspective. And I do see the value of reading like Shakespeare and Paradise Lost and all those things, but even though I don't enjoy it as much, but I definitely wish that we would read more current stuff mm-hmm. along with like the classics. But I think I've enjoyed all of my English classes that I've taken so far. So even if I don't enjoy the novel, the experience of doing it with 20-something other people is always a good time.
Who would you recommend your favorite book of 2019 to? What kind of audience do you think it would most resonate with?
Definitely young adults, people who are interested in a good romance, like myself. and anyone who just kind of wants to connect with a character that is very ambitious and that relates to a lot of people, because I feel like these days, especially with myself, it's easy to become overly ambitious and burn out. And the main character of The Traitor Prince is very much like that.
Repeat the title and the author for us.
The Traitor Prince by C.J. Redwine.
Samiha Islan, thank you so much for coming in.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
And that's hour one in the books. Do you see what I did there?
Oh, it's a pun.
It's a book pun.
Great.
It's a book pun.
I guess we're keeping that.
Yes, we could. We could edit that out, but nope, not on radio. You can't do that. You got to keep it. And we've got many more of Rochester's favorite books coming up in our second hour. You're going to hear from people across the community, different sectors, science, business, activism, and a lot more. Rochester's favorite books. And by the end of the next hour, maybe Megan and I will weigh in on each other's favorite books. What do you think?
I think that's a great idea.
Okay. Rochester's favorite books rolls on right here on Connection.